The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England.
World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
So I want you to just give me some yes or no answers. Which of these local beer manufacturers would you think is considered a craft beer? Ready?
Yeah.
Smutty Nose IPA.
Well, they're kind of all over the place, though, right? Okay, yes or no?
yes. Jeez. Yes or no?
Yes.
Anheuser-Busch.
No way.
603.
Yeah, Kraft.
Okay. Red Hook.
No.
Stoneface.
Anything that sounds mountainy, I'm putting in the craft department. This is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. I'm your host and also the person right now being grilled about craft beer by producer Taylor Quimby. So what's the story here, Taylor?
So as you know, we've been collecting New Hampshire questions from our listeners online, and understanding what is and isn't a craft beer is key to answering one of those questions. Now, it's actually a three-parter, and it goes like this. Is the recent craft beer hype in New Hampshire actually generating business?
Is there factual, significant growth?
Or are these businesses failing in a year? So this question comes to us from a man named Benjamin Kramer. And I decided to call him up. We met at Concord Craft Brewing in downtown Concord. Benjamin actually just lives a few minutes away. He's a technical support engineer for a company that sells 3D printers.
Sounds like a craft brewing kind of dude.
Exactly.
So what made you ask this question in the first place? Are you just a big fan of craft beer?
Yes. I mean, craft beer always feels better. You know, be a locavore, try and buy within state. And yeah, I went to UNH in the Seacoast. So having a Smutty Nose beer always made me feel really good. Yeah. It's like, oh, it just came.
Tell me his name again.
Benjamin Kramer.
Benjamin Kramer.
So in case you didn't know, craft beer has exploded in the past few years all across the country. All you have to do is step into a grocery store and realize that there are way more choices than there used to be. Add to that that there are brew pubs around the state that brew their own beer. There are the specialty beer stores that have popped up.
Can I back up just a second and say, how do you actually define a craft beer? Because like Smutty Nose is sold in stores all over the place. Is it based on quantity? Is it based on the process of making it? What is a craft beer?
So different people I talked to for the story all had different ideas about what makes a craft beer. Benjamin thought it might have to do with volume or how many employees a brewery has. Other people said that craft beer is all about quality and flavor. And then some people said that what makes craft brewery is a commitment to serving the local community.
Right, but we're talking about alcohol, so aren't there some regulations here in New Hampshire about, like, what is a craft beer?
Well, the answer is no. It's not like USDA Organic, where you have to meet some sort of criteria to be able to put craft on your bottle. So to get some sort of definition, I called up the pro-craft industry group called the Brewers Association, and I spoke with their chief economist, Bart Watson.
Here at the Brewers Association, we don't define craft beer. We recognize that might have, you know, different interpretations in the eye of the beer lover. What we do define is a craft brewer, one that's small, independent, and traditional.
So let me put some specifics on that. Small, for the Brewers Association, is less than 6 million barrels of beer per year.
Okay, so what would Anheuser-Busch put out, for example?
A lot more than that. I mean, 6 million barrels of beer is a ton.
That's a lot.
It's like 3% of the entire U.S. beer market. And what's funny is that it used to be 2 million, but they raised their limit when Sam Adams, a.k.a. the Boston Beer Company, exceeded that limit so that Sam Adams could continue to be called a quote-unquote craft beer.
Uh-huh.
So that's what they mean by small. Next is independent. And what that means is that no more than 25% of a craft brewer, no matter how small that operation is, can be owned or controlled by one of the gigantic non-craft brewers like Miller Coors or Anheuser-Busch.
Right. So it's the kind of Ben and Jerry's thing. Once you get sold to a much bigger organization like a conglomerate, you're out of the business.
Yeah. Yeah. So if I'm a home brewer and I only make like 1 gallon of beer, but I'm owned by Miller Coors, I don't get to be considered craft.
Bad investment by Miller Coors, by the way.
And then the third category is traditional. So basically, hard cider doesn't count. You know, it's got to be beer. So let's take New Hampshire's 65 breweries. Subtract the two or three that predominantly make cider or mead. Subtract Anheuser-Busch InBev, obviously. And then subtract Red Hook, because the company that operates their brewery in Portsmouth ironically called the Craft Brew Alliance, is actually owned in part by Anheuser-Busch and therefore also doesn't qualify. And what you've got left is about 60 breweries in New Hampshire that qualify as craft breweries.
Okay, so now that we know which breweries we're actually talking about, let's go back to the first part of Benjamin's three-part question, and I'm not remembering. What was it, Taylor?
Is the craft beer trend in New Hampshire generating business?
We haven't finalized our 2016 numbers yet, but in 2014, we found that the craft brewing industry had a $359 million impact on the state of New Hampshire.
Whoa.
That's pretty big, right?
Things like tourism and beer festivals. 50% of craft drinkers say they visited a brewery more than 2 hours away from their house last year. New Hampshire's one of the highest per capita states for beer sales.
Now, if you want to measure business from this standpoint by job creation, smaller breweries also play a really important role. Because even though Anheuser-Busch, that one facility that I mentioned earlier, they produced about 90% of all the beer brewed in New Hampshire in 2016.
Mm-hmm.
But they only employ about 33% of the direct, brewery-related jobs in the state.
So craft brewing is pretty, let's say, person-intensive as well, obviously.
I loved the way that Bart put this.
From a jobs perspective, there's beautiful inefficiency in being a small brewer.
Beautiful inefficiency.
Inefficiency.
So I think, to me, this answers Benjamin's first question. Yeah, it definitely appears that the craft beer trend is generating business in the state.
But didn't he also ask whether it's sustainable?
Well, the next question was trickier because that's where he asked for specific, factual, and significant growth. As I explained to Benjamin, if you're looking at the number of breweries in New Hampshire, the answer is a resounding yes. Here we've got... In 2006, there were 15 breweries. Now there's 65. So we're talking about a huge explosion in the past 10 years.
And I'm sure you're going to go here, but you can see that the growth is all on the nano brewery side.
Yes.
Is nano brewery and craft brewery mean the same thing?
No, they don't. They don't. What Dennis is talking about there is how breweries are classified by the New Hampshire State Liquor Commission.
Finally, the New Hampshire State Liquor Commission comes into this conversation.
You knew they were going to come in, yeah.
First of all, how long have you been here, Jim?
I've been here for 25 years with the commission.
This is Jim Barbuti, an auditing supervisor for the New Hampshire Liquor Commission.
Okay, so you have seen a lot of changes probably in the past decade.
Yes, I have. I started working in the liquor store. I worked in accounting, marketing. Now I'm in liquor enforcement.
So, from a liquor commission standpoint, the term craft means absolutely nothing. They don't care whether you're brewing a hoppy IPA or a, smooth
jalapeno
porter. What would you do?
I can't even think of it, Taylor.
So, they don't care about that sort of stuff. They care about how much you produce, because the more you produce, the more your licensing fees increase.
Well, we have three different categories to manufacture beer. We have the beverage manufacturer. We have the brew pubs, and then we have a nano brewery.
So three levels. The manufacturers, which are the bigger players like Smutty Nose, Red Hook, Anheuser-Busch, brew pubs like Elm City in Keene or Moat Mountain in North Conway, and then there's the nanos. These are the really small little breweries like Candia Road Brewery or Outhouse Ales. The state actually created the nano license as a way to encourage small brewers in 2011, and since then, the number of breweries has exploded. But
the number of manufacturers have grown tremendously in New Hampshire. Production-wise, it has not. Due to the fact most nano breweries is a one-barrel system, so they can only make 31 gallons at a time, which doesn't go very far.
So let me explain. As Dennis said, most of the new breweries opening in the state these past few years have been these low-volume nanos, and they produce so little beer compared to bigger players like Smutty Nose or Red Hook that the overall amount of beer being produced in the state is actually down. And the growth that we have seen these past few years in terms of those nano breweries, both in terms of, the overall number and the production of the small breweries, which has increased, that increase has slowed down a lot.
What are you thinking about how things may be shifting again, or do you think it's settling down a little bit?
Well, the market's always changing. For the last 25 years, the market's been going up and down. Brew pubs were a hot thing back in the 90s, and then they quieted down. Right now, the market is basically fighting a bunch with each other for shelf space, tap lines, and it's trying to beat out your competitor to get that important spot on the shelves.
Okay, so quick recap. Significant factual growth, the answer, the number of craft breweries is way up. Respective of their size, the amount of beer being produced by those craft breweries is also up, but from that statewide standpoint, nanos just don't produce much beer.
Uh-huh.
And for that reason, tax revenue is not up, it's flat. And even then, people are saying space is getting tight, competition's getting fierce. Which brings us, as I know you've just been dying to know, Benjamin's third and final question. Are most breweries closing inside of a year?
Oh, it's a little bit of a sad question to me.
It is. But it's a happy answer.
The answer to your question, are most of these closing in a year? No. We've seen tons of growth and very few closures, you know, one a year.
Since the Liquor Commission created the Nano Brewery license in 2011, like I said, tons of openings, 27 total, and only 4 have gone out of business.
Wow, I wonder how that compares to a lot of other startups. I mean, that's pretty impressive.
Yeah, or what I was sort of wondering, which is the restaurant industry.
Mm-hmm, right.
Here's Bart with the national perspective.
So last year we saw more than 800 brewery openings and less than 100 closings. And that's pretty typical of what we've seen the last few years. In the long run, that's unsustainable. You can't just have an industry where people only open and no one closes. I don't think it's ever going to look like restaurants where, 60% fail in their first 3 years. But I do think that we're going to see that closing rate rise a little bit, and that's just how market competition works.
Well, Taylor, thank you. That is fascinating stuff. And thanks, Benjamin, for the question.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I took him out for a beer after we were done.
What was going to be a grape knee-high?
Let's cheers.
Cheers. Thank you. Yeah. Another thing that's fun about craft beer is there's always a new glass. It feels just slightly different. I mean, IPA is IPA, but I've never had this one before.
Yeah.
And by the way, you too have the power to send one of our producers out into the field. If you've got a burning question about the place where you live, maybe it's a landmark that you've always wondered about, or a bit of cultural ephemera or local custom that piques your interest, ask us about it. Just go to nhpr.org and you'll find the Only in New Hampshire link. It's on the right side of the website. Click on that and let us know what is making you curious. Okay, let's move on to a piece of local history that I knew absolutely nothing about. The story begins in Manchester's historic mill yards in 1957, when 4 workers at a textile mill died of a mysterious illness, an event that triggered a massive public health investigation and ended with the demolition of an entire building. NHPR's Todd Bookman brings us the story.
Antonio Jetti was a middle-aged, medium-sized guy. He worked inside the card room at the Arms Textile Mill.
And the card room is a place where all the wool comes in little bunches.
This is Jetty's daughter, Anita Simons.
And it works down through these machines and it comes out as one strand of yarn.
Simons also worked in the Manchester mill yard.
In fact, I worked in the same mill as he did for a while. I was a weaver.
Today, Simons is 90 years old, no longer a weaver. In September of 1957, though, she was 30 years old, pregnant with her 4th child, and she vividly remembers her dad's illness. It started on Labor Day weekend. Jetti had a fever, no appetite, no energy, and a cough. On Thursday, September 5th, he woke up early for Mass. Then, still not feeling well, he went back home.
He went upstairs, he fell across the bed, and when my sister came home at noon, he was unconscious on the bed, and the doctor came.
By evening, Jetti was transported to St. Joseph Hospital in Nashua with a fever of 105 degrees, his breathing rapid and shallow. Anita and her 6 siblings and her mom held a vigil at his bedside.
And that's it. He never woke up.
Antonio Jetti, an otherwise healthy 49-year-old employee of the Arms Textile Mill, died on the morning of September 6th. Can I ask, what did the doctors think had caused this?
They didn't know, and neither did my mother know. I think they put cerebral hemorrhage on the death certificate.
It wasn't a cerebral hemorrhage. Antonio Jetti, along with 2 other men and 1 woman, all employees at the Arms Mill, died after inhaling anthrax. How and why that happened would take some time to figure out.
I've written a book about anthrax entitled Death in a Small Package.
Susan Jones is a professor at the University of Minnesota and a specialist in zoonotic diseases. Zoonotic meaning diseases transmitted between animals and humans. To understand how anthrax got inside the Arms textile mill, you have to understand how anthrax lives, how this bacteria exists in the world. Jones says picture a field and a herd of cattle grazing. Anthrax can be hidden on the grass. The cow eats it, gets sick, and dies.
One of the things that the disease does is to cause a great deal of bleeding from all the bodily orifices after death. And that blood contains a lot of bacilli, spills out over the grass. Slowly but surely, the carcass rots, goes away. Other animals come along, eat the grass, and you can see that life cycle continuing in this way.
Susan, you've made this even more horrifying than I thought it could be.
That's what you get for talking with a veterinarian.
So that's the terrible way animals get and die from the anthrax bacteria. In humans, there are three different sources.
The first is you can eat it in infected meat. That's very rare in the United States. Or you can get it into an open wound in the skin called the cutaneous form of anthrax. And the third way, and the most deadly way, is inhalational anthrax.
Inhaling it is, of course, how most of us know about anthrax, as a biological weapon stuffed inside of an envelope or a package. More on that in a minute. Cutaneous anthrax, the second form, is much more common. It causes a nasty-looking black sore to form on the skin. And this was actually a well-known hazard inside textile mills in the era. It even had a name, wool sorter's disease. Still, in 1957 at the Arms Mill, Susan Jones says it took investigators a while to figure out the cause. And that was in part because the men and women getting sick worked in different parts of the building.
Some of them worked at the beginning of the process, opening the bales. Some of them worked during the weaving process. Some of them removed bits of wool and hair from the machines. The only thing they had in common was that they had all participated in the processing of a single shipment of Pakistani goat hair.
A single batch of dark-colored Pakistani goat hair. Hair that was used to make the lining of men's jackets. As the goat hair worked its way through the Arms Mill, the anthrax spores were sent airborne, floating down like confetti on the workers. In total, 9 people became sick, 5 with inhalation anthrax, and 4 more with skin lesions. It was the first epidemic of its kind in U.S. history. And it actually could have been worse, except for a remarkable twist. In 1957, the United States Army, along with the CDC, happened to be testing a potential anthrax vaccine. And those tests were taking place at 4 textile mills, including the Arms Mill.
So it was pure luck that it happened. You know, luck is maybe not the right word, but it was pure coincidence that they happened to have the outbreak here when they were testing the vaccine.
This is Suzanne DeBella Olson with the Manchester Historic Association. When scientists realized what was happening, they halted their trial and gave the vaccine to every worker at the Arms Mill. And no one else got sick. In fact, that experimental vaccine became the basis for the one given today to soldiers. As for the Arms Mill, they kept right on rolling for another decade, until in 1968, when the company went out of business.
So the building in 1971 was taken down. It was one of the largest decontamination projects in the world at the time.
Men in white suits sprayed the inside with chlorine and formaldehyde. An incinerator was brought on site to the mill yard.
And then they took the building down and buried the bricks off site.
And that was that. But of course, this wasn't the end for anthrax.
America strikes back. Anthrax.
Rare inhaled Another form of anthrax.
The nation after anthrax is found at a
The anthrax letters, arriving shortly after 9/11, killed 5 people. They were eventually traced to a government scientist, but not before ramping up panic in a country already consumed by it. A few years later, that fear would reemerge, this time back in Manchester. Construction was underway on a new baseball stadium. It was being built on the site where bricks from the Arms textile mill were buried. Utility workers did actually hit those bricks while sinking some electric poles, which prompted more tests and a few scary headlines. But in the end, no one got sick. Tim Soucy is the city's public health director.
You know, I think it was driven by fear and not by science at the time, to be honest with you, because we knew the history of these bricks and the level of decontamination that they had gone through. There was really, you know, can you ever say zero risk? No, but probably as close to zero as you could get.
Antonio Getty, in 1957, probably didn't rate his risk of dying from anthrax as all that likely either. His daughter, Anita Simons, says the whole scenario just didn't make any sense.
We didn't even know what anthrax was.
Her family eventually came to understand that the spores had been hiding inside of goat hair where Getty worked, that they were released into the air and then took away her dad. For NHPR News, I'm Todd Bookman.
With us for a different kind of history lesson, Civics 101 delves into the 25th Amendment. That's the constitutional prescription for what happens if a president dies or becomes ill or resigns or gets kicked out of office.
There were sort of unspoken norms about what would happen if a president became disabled. And throughout history, there were many presidents who were quietly incapacitated.
Class begins after a short break.
Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott, and it's time for another edition of Civics 101, a podcast refresher course on some basics you may have forgotten or slept through in school. The 25th Amendment was passed in 1965 and ratified in 1967 and was meant to add some clarity to the question of what happens when a president or vice president dies, is removed from office, or resigns. We've received quite a few questions about the 25th Amendment, which has been the subject of recent op-eds and analysis, so we thought it a good time to look at the history and protocols of presidential succession. Lana Ulrich is Associate In-House Counsel for the National Constitution Center. Hello, Lana.
Hi, Virginia.
So the framers addressed the question of presidential succession at the Constitutional Convention, and this was back in 1787. What exactly were they debating then?
Well, they were debating exactly how they should frame the language addressing presidential succession in the Constitution. And they went back and forth as to how to say, you know, what happens when the president becomes disabled? Should there be an election? Should there not be an election? And so they finally settled on the language that is included in the original Constitution in Article 2, Section 1, Clause 6, which says, in case of the removal of the president from office or of his death, resignation, or inability to discharge the powers and duties of the said office, the same shall devolve on the vice president, and the Congress may by law provide for the case of removal, death, resignation, or inability, both of the president and the vice president, declaring what officer shall then act as president, and such officer shall act accordingly until the disability be removed or a president shall be elected.
Mm-hmm.
And that seemed to clarify a bit as to what would happen, but it didn't answer all of the questions, and there was one delegate in particular, Dickinson, who, you know, was taking notes during the debate and sort of wrote to himself, what is the extent of the term disability and who is to be judge of it? Basically, the question that he asked himself was not answered at the time and is still something that is debated to this day.
Yeah, and this was revisited again in 1792. Why then?
Yes. So according to the language that I just read in Article 2, the framers knew that they were going to have to fill in some of the gaps that were left open. And so they enabled Congress to provide by law later on for more specific mechanisms to elaborate on presidential succession.
So go over with me, if you would, just quickly, president, vice president.
Then it under the first Presidential Succession Act, it was the president pro tempore of the Senate, and then followed by the Speaker of the House. But there was actually no provision to replace a vice president should the vice president die or resign at that time.
All right. So this became a sticking point when President William Henry Harrison died. Now, this is, 1841, and Vice President Tyler stepped in. What happened?
Right. So William Henry Harrison was the first president to die in office, and he died on April 4th, 1841. His vice president, John Tyler, basically just insisted that he became president of the United States and was not merely acting president. This became known as the quote-unquote Tyler precedent, and it was pretty controversial. Not everyone agreed that the vice president automatically became president, even if the president died in office. Even former President John Quincy Adams wrote to himself, I paid a visit this morning to Mr. Tyler, who styled himself president of the United States and not vice president acting as president, which should be the correct style.
Huh. So previously it had been thought of as acting, and he said, no, I'm president.
Yeah, I mean, I think there were some that may have agreed with his interpretation, but as you know, John Quincy Adams did not. But Tyler basically took the oath of office, he gave an inaugural speech, and he moved into the White House. And so there, just to quell any doubts that he was in fact president, they were silenced at that time.
How many times has this even been called into question? I mean, how many times has a president died or in office or left office?
There have been 8 presidents actually to die in office, and all the vice presidents all took over for those presidents. One vice president resigned in office, and 7 vice presidents also died in office.
Mm. So this brings us to the 25th Amendment. When was it introduced and why?
The Tyler precedent went on for a long time, and there were sort of unspoken norms about what would happen if, at the same time, if a president became disabled. And throughout history, there were many presidents who were quietly incapacitated, and due to many reasons, including the fact that there was no constitutional mechanism in place, they just kind of worked quietly behind the scenes to keep his illness under wraps until the next election. I mean, this happened, you know, with Woodrow Wilson, had a severe stroke, and for a long period of time toward the end of his term, he was essentially not acting as president. But basically his wife and his cabinet were just kind of acting in his stead. And so this was fine for a while, but then right around the time of President Eisenhower, who was also ill, and which coincided with the Cold War, it became clear that we needed something that was a bit more formalized. And I think the crucial moment in time was after President John F. Kennedy was assassinated, and that sort of provided the bipartisan support for this kind of amendment that didn't really have a lot of special interest support, but it was just something that was kind of a good idea and something that the country seemed to need.
Mm, especially, as you mentioned, during the Cold War, the whole idea that, you know, a nuclear strike could happen at any moment. Somebody had to be in charge.
Exactly, yeah.
Well, let's dig into the parts of this 25th Amendment. 4 parts. Section 1 states that in the case of the removal of the president from office or of his death or resignation, the vice president shall become president. So that's basically what Tyler did, right?
Exactly, yeah. This basically just constitutionalized the Tyler precedent. And so when President Nixon resigned in 1974, Vice President Ford became president under Section 1.
Okay, Section 2 gives the president the authority to nominate a new vice president should that job be vacated. So how's that different than before the amendment was ratified?
So this requires the president to nominate a vice president when the office is vacant, subject to the confirmation by a majority of the House and the Senate. So in 1973, Gerald Ford became vice president through Section 2 after Vice President Spiro Agnew resigned. And then when Ford took over the presidency the next year, he invoked Section 2 and nominated Nelson Rockefeller to fill his vice presidential vacancy.
All right, then Section 3. Now, this is a situation in which the president transmits a written declaration stating that they are unable to discharge the powers or duties of their office to the House and Senate. So transferring duties to the vice president who would serve as acting president, has this ever been used?
Yes, actually, it has. It's been used 3 times. most recently by President George W. Bush in 2007 and in 2002 when he was undergoing a medical operation. And so Vice
May
President
I add colonoscopy?
Yes. Yes. Very important operation. And so Vice President Cheney was briefly acting president. And then in 1985, President Ronald Reagan was also about to undergo colon cancer surgery. And so he designated Vice President George H.W. Bush to be acting president.
So they have to, a president would have to be in one's right mind in order to transfer that power, correct?
One would assume so, yes, since it requires a written declaration to both transfer the power and then to resume power after the president's disability is removed, yes.
Well, let's look at Section 4, because this has been a topic of debate. And as I mentioned, op-eds, a lot of scrutiny in recent months. Can you explain what Section 4 lays out?
Yeah, so Section 3 is the voluntary transfer of power, but Section 4 details what happens when there may need to be an involuntary transfer of power, when the president, for it's assumed medical reasons, is unable to make that conscious decision, whether he's in a coma or whether he has maybe a very severe mental impairment, progressed dementia. In that situation, it allows for the vice president to be the crucial decider, essentially, and working with either the heads of the cabinets, the heads of the departments, and or a disability review body that Congress may establish to determine that the president is no longer able to fulfill his duties and therefore trigger Section 4 and mechanisms by which to involuntarily take power away from the president.
Has this ever been invoked?
No, it hasn't. And it's controversial for many reasons, one being in that it takes power away from a duly elected president, essentially. But the other is that it's never been invoked. So we don't really know how the procedure and the practice will play out. And there are a number of gaps that are still left open, despite Section 3 and 4 being a little bit better than what we had, which is namely nothing. So there's a lot of open questions under this mechanism. And so it's, as you said, very controversial.
Well, and I also remember during the Reagan presidency, some suspicions that he was suffering from Alzheimer's, which, of course, we found out he was. Was this ever even discussed?
It was. I think that some of his aides had discussed that among themselves, I think especially after Iran-Contra happened, and they briefly discussed it, and then I think they decided to do a case study, and they went the next day and spoke with the president and sort of interviewed him, and then they decided, well, he was acting completely normal, and so they felt that it wasn't appropriate at that time to invoke Section 4, but they had kicked the idea around.
Section 4 would mean the vice president would have to initiate it, so it would have been George H.W. Bush at that point?
Yeah, under Section 4, the vice president is really the one who starts the process to determine that the president is disabled. And then if the president has the opportunity to contest that, but then the vice president and the department heads can go back to Congress and contest the president's contesting essentially as well. And so and if they're successful, then the vice president becomes acting president.
But is that a purely political decision, or is it a medical decision? Like, could a panel of doctors say this president is undergoing, he's in a coma, he's not able to discharge his duties?
It seems that some sort of medical issue should be present, because we have impeachment, and that's a political process for removing the president. And I think that the 25th Amendment contemplates some kind of disability other than the president is. Maybe did something illegal, is just not performing well. There's got to be something else there, but it's not ultimately up to, say, the White House doctor to make that decision. I think the vice president may certainly consult with the president's doctors and ask for an opinion, but ultimately, I think it does boil down to a political decision to actually take that step to say, okay, we're going to invoke Section 4 of the 25th Amendment.
So in some ways, that question of determining a disability and who is to be the judge of it, still not completely answered, is it?
No, it's definitely not. John Dickinson's question is yet unanswered. There's definitely some guidelines one could could say. I mean, I think most people would agree, for instance, if the president is in a coma, then probably that might apply. But again, you know, now with medical technology, it's not clear whether or not that might be a permanent disability or not. So yes, it's definitely still an open question. And I think it's going to depend on maybe, you know, obviously a future situation that would call for the application of the amendment to see how it kind of plays out in real life.
Lana Ulrich, she's associate in-house counsel for the National Constitution Center. That is a nonpartisan institution. It was established by Congress to disseminate information about the U.S. Constitution. The goal, in order to increase awareness and understanding of the Constitution among the American people, which is what we're doing too. So thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Virginia.
Understanding the Constitution can be difficult, even though it's taught and freely available to the public. Navigating local government can also be challenging. The New Hampshire Parole Board plays a key role in the state's criminal justice system. Its 9 members decide which inmates get out on parole and whether parolees have to return to prison. Parole hearings are open to the public, but take place with little oversight or public scrutiny. And that's one reason NHPR's Emily Corwin decided to check them out and discovered that, unlike most legal proceedings, these hearings can be surprisingly unrefined.
It's all brick and pavement outside the prison. I'm standing at a sort of side entrance. There are 3 locked doors between me and the place I'm going. This building used to be the warden's residence. There's a room upstairs where 3 parole board members sit 5 hours a day, twice a week. Donna Sitek chairs the board.
It is probably the cleanest building in the state because the only place I've ever been where they empty the waste baskets twice a day because they have all this free labor.
She's talking about inmates. Inside, hearings take place in what looks like a courtroom. Parole board members sit behind a wooden bench. Often, new lawyers stand up to address the board. They're told to sit down. This is not a courtroom. It often doesn't sound like one, either.
I know I shouldn't be chewing your ass like this, but you know damn well what I'm talking about. You know
that's
right.
Parole board member Jeff Brown during a hearing in February. A month earlier, the colorful Leslie Mendenhall, another board member.
Well, the thing about a good car salesman is they know how to blow smoke up your ass with smiling to your face and telling you absolutely lies.
NHPR reviewed 20 hours of parole hearings from the last year. These are the voices of public officials tasked with making decisions about people's liberty and community safety. Where we expected civility, we found foul language and confrontation.
Well, there is a perception that the parole board is sort of like the Wild West. The rules are loosely applied.
David Hendricks spent hundreds of hours in parole hearings as a public defender. He says lawyers take things for granted in a courtroom that go by the wayside here. Like in court, hearsay and unsworn testimony are not valid. At a parole hearing, these are seemingly fair game. Decorum, he says, can also go out the window.
Transferring to extension 102.
Many hearings take place by video conference. The board has about 15 minutes to decide if people convicted of sex offenses, drug crimes, domestic violence, can live safely outside prison walls. They do this with no training or prerequisite experience. Only 3 must be lawyers. Inmates who meet the minimum requirements are almost always granted parole. I was at a hearing a few months back when Adam Smart got paroled. His mother sat next to me at the back of the room. He told the board he's struggled with addiction. He said he didn't get as much drug treatment as he would have liked behind bars. He said he's been on a waiting list for treatment in the community. And he said his counselor wasn't very helpful. At some point as he spoke, board member Leslie Mendenhall decided he was making excuses.
I think you're full of and I think you're just trying to sell a nice boat down the river. You're full of it. It's You're all, full of yourself.
It's all on record, right? Every time we go on the mental health.
Every single time.
Okay. So you can
and
see
And what
that
are you taking for medications?
Nothing.
Nothing.
No.
Why?
Because they want to put me on sleep meds for anxiety.
Right, because do you know one of the best things you can do for bipolar is to make sure that you get a solid amount of sleep, because that helps stable your mood?
I don't know if I have bipolar.
You're sure presenting like a bipolar.
It strikes me as completely inappropriate. It's certainly not the parole board's role to advise them on their mental health issues.
I met Phil Utter at another parole hearing. He's a private defense attorney. I played the exchange back for him.
And swearing at an inmate? How can that possibly be helpful? This is a person who's going to be reintegrating into society at some point, and if you start belittling them, it's just wrong. It's just wrong.
David Hendricks, the attorney who called the board the Wild West, went into more detail.
You know, their job is to demonstrate conduct that takes seriously laws, takes seriously the principles of what their job is.
He says he fears when a government official denigrates someone, they can lose faith in the entire system and become less likely to abide by laws. Mendenhall chose not to be interviewed for the story. The board's chair, Donna Sitek, says things used to be even more informal.
That's one of the reasons I asked to be appointed to the parole board. I didn't think the hearings were accorded the dignity that the parties and the process deserve.
Sitek is a former New Hampshire House Speaker who published a guide to political etiquette. She calls Mendenhall's exchange inappropriate. Still, she says confrontation can be constructive for some inmates. Another board member, Brian Cashman, defended the tough talk. He said it's important to let inmates know insincerity won't be tolerated.
If you're going to get their attention, you have to get their attention.
And Cashman said feeling deceived by an inmate can make you emotional.
I try not to, but sometimes it just comes out.
Attorney David Hendricks says he knows how frustrating the job is, and he knows just how fraught the justice system can be. But being polite?
That is something that is not very difficult to achieve and is sort of a bare minimum that we should just frankly expect.
For NHPR News, I'm Emily Corwin.
All right, in just a minute, we're going to put aside politics and parole boards for a little break with a 10-minute writer's workshop. This week, Jonathan Safran Foer, author of Everything is Illuminated, talks about one of the most difficult aspects of creativity, conviction.
It's hard to make a decision at one point in life and live with it over time. It's hard in books. It's hard in professions. It's hard in, you know, oftentimes at the end of a meal, I regret the thing that I ordered at the beginning of the meal.
Stick with us. Word of Mouth continues in just a minute.
This is the 10-Minute Writer's Workshop with Jonathan Safran Foer.
Author, outspoken vegetarian, social media abstainer, and writing teacher, Jonathan Safran Foer is the author of three novels. Everything is Illuminated, Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close, and most recently, Here I Am, which follows four generations of a Jewish family grappling with identity, connection, and disaster. He's also author of the nonfiction book, Eating Animals, which was a New York Times bestseller, and at least one libretto for opera. I spoke to him from a studio in New York and asked him which is most difficult for him, the first sentence or the last.
A first sentence is difficult in a way that is different than how a last sentence is difficult. It's hard when everything is a possibility in the beginning and there's no constraints which might nudge you onto a path. There's no infrastructure. And it's hard at the end when everything feels inevitable and that, you know, the choices in front of you are effectively none.
How much plotting or planning are you doing before you even sit down to write?
None at all. Or rather, none that I end up sticking with. I have a lot of ideas that I think would be good for novels. And whenever I try to execute them, I always stop caring at some point. And I think it's because it's hard to make a decision at one point in life and live with it over time. It's hard in books. It's hard in professions, it's hard in relationships, it's hard in, you know, oftentimes at the end of a meal, I regret the thing that I ordered at the beginning of the meal. So what I try to do as a writer is to be open to a process that allows for stumbling upon things and accidents, allows for the changing of my mind, allows for the changing of the world. You know, if most books take most writers 2 years or 3 years to write. So a lot happens in 2 or 3 years. You're not the same person at the end that you were at the beginning, and the world is not the same.
The novel Here I Am, your most recent novel, I understand that took you 11 years to write?
Well, yes and no. In those 11 years, I wrote a nonfiction book, Eating Animals, about factory farming. I had two kids. I watched a lot of TV. I did, you know, ate a lot of popcorn. But the reality is I didn't have anything that I cared about enough. I didn't have a novel project, that is, that I cared about enough to work on it in the ways that are necessary for me. I came to writing sort of through the back door. It was not my dream to be a novelist. And I don't feel any kind of like pressure or obligation or guilt when it comes to the amount of time it takes to finish a book. I feel pressure and guilt and obligation to myself when I notice that I'm working on something that I don't really care about. A byproduct of making any kind of serious effort is you question to what extent it's worth it.
Were there unfinished works that you started at the time and maybe abandoned because, as you said, you didn't care about them enough?
Yeah, many. Yeah. Many, many, many. Although I don't always, or it's rare that I work that discreetly, so I could even say this belongs to this and this belongs to that. Hmm. More, I just write. I mean, there's a wonderful story about Jackson Pollock toward the end of his life. He was painting out in the Hamptons, and he would unroll these massive swaths of canvas, and he would paint the whole thing. And when it dried, he would walk over it and say, this is a good 4x6 painting. This is a good 5x10 painting, and cut them from the larger piece and stretch them. And I write a little bit like that. I overwrite, and I write in a lot of directions. I'm not writing toward any known outcome. Or at least not for a long time. Of course, there's a point when, you know, with like a novel or any work of length, when you start to really know what it is that you have in front of you and work toward its completion. But for me, that's maybe the last 10% of the time that I work on a book. You know, when I surprise myself with something comes up, that's not only is it more fun and more interesting, but the writing is writing I'm more proud of.
I love that story about Pollock because it also recognizes that he recognizes that this 4x6 piece is the piece. How about that discernment process for you, knowing what is the good stuff after you've been working or thrashing or bumbling, as you said, through something?
Well, I think that's a really, really good question or a good observation. It's much harder to know that something is good than to make something that's good, if that makes sense. What always frustrates me as a writer and what really can, you know, drive me crazy is the feeling of being unable to tell what is good. Or another way of describing that, I guess, is that nothing looks good to me. You know, the reality of writing is that if most people tried very hard and devoted real time to it, they could do it. I will never dunk a basketball, but if LeBron James wanted to write a great sentence, he could. And what distinguishes, I think, great writers from people who are not great writers or are not writers at all, taste, you know, and not taste in the sense of knowing what is good in an objective way, because there's nothing objective to point to. There's nothing to refer to out in the world. But knowing what it is that you yourself respond to, and then making the leap of faith that if you respond strongly to something, there will be people in the world who also respond strongly.
Do you have a fantasy job other than writer?
I mean, being first baseman for the Washington Nationals wouldn't be so bad.
I think that job's taken right now.
Well, all the jobs that I would want are taken right now, apart from, you know, being Zeus. I don't know. I had always imagined myself as a doctor, you know? That's what I thought I would do. I imagined myself as an obstetrician. I thought that would be a great way to spend a life. It's funny, you know? In a way, it's the opposite of being a writer. No obstetrician comes home at the end of the week and says, ugh, I delivered 20 babies, what's the point? You know? But with being a writer, the question of what's the point is like always there, always, whoever you are, whatever what kind of writer you are. And it's glaring, and it's very, very difficult to respond to because it's just not obvious.
Jonathan Safran Foer, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Jonathan Safran Foer, author most recently of the novel Here I Am. Thank you so much for your listening time today. Music in this episode came from Latch Swing, Ketza, and Broke for Free. You can subscribe to the 10-Minute Writers Workshop, Civics 101, and all of NHPR's podcasts in Apple Podcasts or Google Play. It's really easy to put them in a playlist and pick and choose the things that you like the most. And don't forget, we want to hear your ideas and questions and tips about the place that you call home. Go to nhpr.org and find the Only in New Hampshire link. It's on the right side of the screen. So far, we've had questions about ghost towns, car inspections, and New Hampshire's secret archaeological sites. And we are having such a blast finding answers to the questions we've received so far. So we welcome yours and invite you to keep listening in for the answers. I'm Virginia Prescott. That's all we have time for today, but talk to you next time with more stories told by word of mouth here on NHPR.
Word of Mouth is produced by Molly Donahue, Logan Shannon,
and Jimmy Gutierrez.
Our senior producer is
Taylor Quimby,
and our executive producer is Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production
of New Hampshire Public Radio.